The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
The markets are going to be on edge with November fast approaching, but there are real tangible implications if you're talking about tax policy, which would shift with that president, impacting corporate profits and thus impacting prices. So, you know, regardless of what the Fed does to suspend the sun, moon, and stars, they're going to have a lot more heavy lifting to do given a certain outcome.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, a lot of things can change in a week, Dave, but I want to start with you talking a little bit about your first 100-mile ride. I mean, you've done a lot of endurance types of sports, but you're training for this Ironman, full Ironman, and you told me about the 100-mile ride and what you were doing the last, 20, 25 miles. I think you were just white lining.
Yeah, it's sobering when you think, I've got to get off the bike at 112 miles and then run a marathon. I did run 2 or 3 miles afterwards, and the first couple were downhill and felt great.
Yeah.
And then it just flattened out, and I thought I was going to die. So, no, I mean, there was a point at which I'm just staring at the white line and just listening to the sound of the wheel as I'm going down the road.
Well,
and
we've talked about long rides. You know, you have to sometimes just focus on making circles. You just make circles because otherwise you're just going to want to quit. And, you know, with the run, you and I have talked about doing a little bit of an inventory of your body. And with the swim, what's your form like? You know, if you can turn your brain to focus on the simple things, you know, especially when things get really, really painful, I think that's really the key, isn't it?
Yeah, I think one of the ways that you manage volatility, whether it's your own emotional volatility in something like this race that I'm training for, or even in a portfolio as an individual investor, if you're looking at technique and rules and guidelines, as opposed to focusing and fixating on a goal, you can create your own volatility by fixating on the goal. One day it seems to be moving away from you, and then the next day it's moving back towards you, and you can drive yourself crazy that way.
Well, look at the dollar. Okay, the dollar has been rallying, and gold and the stock market, some of these other assets that have been rising are going down. But really, if we look beyond that, if we're looking at the longer term, we have to say, all right, has anything changed? We've got inflation expectations. I mean, look at what Bullard had to say about inflation. Even the Fed is preparing us for higher inflation.
Yeah, and I thought his comments were edifying. There's a good chance of an economic boom following the COVID-19 pandemic. That was one of his observations, which, of course, off of a very low base of economic activity, that's not difficult to predict.
Sure.
But his inflation comment, that inflation would run hotter than expected, is directly to my point in recent weeks. You adjust that inflation target. That's a new policy regime. You put it to higher levels to allow for what is in essence a wider credibility band.
Well, you know, sometimes in politics, we look for the October surprise. Everybody's holding their breath for the October surprise. But beyond that, are we looking for an inflation surprise?
I think there is an inflation surprise coming. And I think we had the quote from the Goldman Sachs commodity man last week, Jeffrey Curry, basically saying the same thing. You've got the political temptation to alleviate the debt burdens which are being created today. So right now it's about balance sheet expansion, accommodation of the market. And then there is, in the final analysis, what you do with all that debt. And so we're creating it today. That's great. How do you deal with it tomorrow? It's actually a fairly straightforward playbook.
You were talking about call options recently and writing call options. And a lot of times when these options start to expire, when there's an expiration date, you get volatility that's predictable ahead of time. I'd like you to talk a little bit about the triple witching date, the expiration date, and why we see this kind of volatility when that happens.
Yeah, this is kind of an odd comparison, but I have a hard time escaping the training patterns that I'm in right now. I did a swim earlier this week and decided I didn't have much time, so I was just going to bang it out as fast as I could. And technique went away, and I swam. It was a terrible swim. Swallowed more water than I have in a long time. And it was just, the whole experience was weird, but it was a little bit like options trading because my perspective in terms of time changed dramatically. Mm. And when you shift your perspective, I was in a rush.
Yeah.
And what mattered was the next 2 minutes, the next 5 minutes, the next 20 minutes. And I was not taking sort of the long view, which again comes back to this idea of if you have a long-term view, which is informing your approach, then technique and rules and disciplines all of a sudden become very important, and you're able to deal with the day in, day out, the minute by minute in a very orderly and calm fashion.
Right. And that's why you have a team with your money management. That team helps each other with discipline.
And I've noticed that folks that shift to trading call options, they don't even care what tomorrow holds. It's really how the market closes today.
Mm.
And everything is tied to the nanosecond. And there really is no long view. There is no technique. There is no goal except how do I get rich as fast as possible? And they're looking to drive home a result that ultimately isn't sustainable. And you'll notice that the people with real money in the options world are the writers of options, not the buyers or the purchasers.
It's like Vegas. We'll sell you the gaming. Okay,
yeah, that's
but
right.
Don't game.
Yeah, because 96% of options, or it used to be, I haven't looked at the numbers in the last year, but it used to be upwards of 96% of options expire worthless. So the folks who are writing those options are making a mint, and the people who are speculating, thinking that they're going to make a vast fortune, 4% do, 96% don't. I mean, it really is worse odds than Vegas.
And you don't get free drinks in a show.
No, that's right. So this last week was fascinating too, because you've got September expiration, last Friday, known as triple witching. That's three different expirations occurring on the same day. You've got index futures, you've got index options, and you've got stock options all expiring. And it sets up for targeted market volatility. Again, the writer of the call option would love to see those options trade lower or even become worthless.
It's like Vegas. They want to see you lose. They want you to have a good time, but they certainly don't want you to walk away a winner.
Then they get to keep the money.
Right.
You paid a premium for that option. So there's typically quite a bit of volatility around those days, either the expiration day or in this case, triple witching, where you've got all three happening at the same time. Monday of this week gave us kind of a first broad-based deleveraging we've seen in a while. Mm. You've got options expiration. That was a lingering factor from Friday. You've got NASDAQ, which has borne the brunt of the correction at this point. But again, not earlier this week. It covered all indices. And as we mentioned a few weeks ago from Doug Nolan's Credit Bubble Bulletin, this mania in call options from unseasoned investor has driven the call writer.
Mm.
The person who actually wins most of the time, in order to avoid unlimited upside risk, or theoretically unlimited upside risk, they've bought the underlying stocks, the underlying assets.
Well, don't they have to sell those assets? They buy them because they have the call option that they've put out there.
And they're trying to hedge their losses, right?
So
that is added energy to the rally.
But then they sell.
That's right. Then you've got expiration, that's Friday. The need to hold the underlying asset diminishes, selling ensues. Here we are. Okay. So earlier this week, selling ensued. And this week has been, I think, a good case in point. We also have, as we look towards the end of the week, what JP Morgan estimates as a $200 billion end of quarter rebalancing. So institutions coming out of stocks and moving into bonds. And again, this follows the sort of March to date rally in equities. It'd be no surprise if the selling intensified as the week went on, as we move towards Thursday and Friday of this week. And again, it's a rebalance out of, before we get to the end of the quarter, out of stocks and into bonds.
And you're going to keep watching what it costs, the cost for insuring default, right? I mean, that's something we've been talking about in the past few weeks, because the insurance for default really has not risen much. People right now are not worried about default. What's your thought going forward?
You begin to see acute concern in some of those areas like default insurance, credit default swaps, or if you see significant shifts in safe haven buying or even in the gold market. And, and these are all areas where there's some clues as to where pressure may be increasing within the financial system.
What about Europe, though? I mean, Europe seems to be what's also boosting the dollar. Europe seems to be throwing weakness out themselves, and the dollar is rallying.
Yeah, and this week in particular, it's a huge issue with European banks, where all of a sudden there's concern again about European banks owning too much government debt and actually, you know, sort of being on the wrong side of the trade, loading up with something that they believe to be bulletproof. But again, it's what they're doing is in essence trading bonds versus investing in a stream of future incomes. So, you know, what does that mean? The Financial Times article titled European Banks Load Up on Government Bonds, Raising Concerns Over a Doom Loop. What it did
a
is it
doom loop. Right. I love that.
It shined a light on the potential weakness in the euro. We've had in the last 5-6 weeks, weakness in the dollar strengthened the euro. Okay. Then this question of stability in European banks sets a very different tone for the euro this week. And so the euro's weakening, dollar strengthening compared to the euro.
Is that why gold showed just a correction? It's not really a crash, but it's a correction.
That's right. So as the euro came back under pressure, traders' response has been to buy back dollars and in turn increase temporary pressure on gold. And we'll see if that continues. The dollar chart has been suggestive of a rally higher. As our guys on Golden Rule Radio noted last week, and if you don't tune into that, I think it's a helpful couple of minutes midweek. And, you know, looking at the charts, it's suggestive that you could see a rally for a number of weeks, 3 to as many as 6 weeks.
Which would be good for gold and silver as far as a correction on the downside. When I say good, for the person who's waiting to put more money in, you like these dips.
Well, the move from 1050 to ultimately what I think is about 5,000 as a target price is not a straight line. And so after each incremental move higher to see some form of consolidation, either moving sideways or down, it's pretty normal.
And
it's
healthy.
Pretty healthy if you're going to set the stage for something higher.
Yeah.
There's always the risk that at a critical point, it can break down. And so that's where, you know, looking at a lot of macro factors are key. But right now, it's euro weakness, a dollar rally, gold retrenchment, all sort of knee-jerk trading patterns that don't have to hold. You can actually have a strong dollar and gold performing well to the upside simultaneously. But look, given the year-to-date gains in both the white and yellow metals, a further move lower is not a surprise. So consolidation of gains is healthy, I think, for further gains to occur as we move towards 2021. And we gave you some of the estimates from B of A, Goldman, and some banks last week. Very telling is the year-to-date gains in GLD, not just in the price, but also the inflows. The demand has been picking up actually the largest year, and this is you know, at this point in the year, the largest amount of demand since the inception for that particular product. 900 tons of gold put into that program. That's inflows, again, largest since inception. And frankly, there's enough hot money flowing into those exchange-traded products to flow right back out and maintain some pressure on the metals. But the fundamentals for gold and silver, I think, remain very much intact. And the benefit of the doubt, if you're talking about a longer-term bull market, still is with the bullish side of the equation, a bullish bias.
You know, we talked about how much can change in a week, and we don't have to go into detail. We can talk later about, you know, I mean, everything from the Supreme Court to, you know, with the riots that have been going on. But it seems that there's a pause right now. The government's been stepping in and pretty much paying for the COVID situation. And right now, the Democrats and the Republicans, they're not getting along. They're not, I'm wondering, the fiscal initiatives. Are we done for the year? Are we just because the Democrats are not going to come to an agreement unless they get their $2.2 trillion?
You mentioned the riots. Before you move off of that, there's the, you know, issue of if you have a revolving door as you bring the folks in who've been tearing the town apart and just, you know, book them and then let them go, they're right back to the streets to do it again.
Highly trained sometimes
was
too.
It Lancaster, PA, $1 million bond for anyone who was rioting, and guess what? They had one night of riots. That was it. Surprise, surprise that
really
incentives somehow align and people say to themselves, I guess that doesn't work for me.
$1 million bond. Yeah, I think that would change my mind.
Well, yeah, it's the fiscal initiatives, which, I mean, again, we're marching fast towards November. And so that really does put a hold on the fiscal initiatives. You've got Pelosi insisting on her version of a $2.2 trillion deal. You get the GOP sponsoring a $1.52 trillion package, which has already been shut down. And so, you know, it's a stalemate. It's a temporary hiatus in liquidity. That liquidity was flowing to individuals and businesses, you know, a few hundred bucks to individuals still going. But it was interesting. Yelp put a total number of business closures due to COVID now sort of in the permanent closure category at 60% of the ones that they're tracking anyways. And so the lingering effects of the government shutting down the economy, those effects are growing. We feel it in our own community. Mm-hmm. There's shops that are closing for good. There's a few of our favorite restaurants unable to negotiate more accommodative terms. They've run out of their funding. And I think the reality is on the other side of the equation is a leveraged landlord that, you know, faces the music with a banker and is not willing to negotiate more accommodative terms with rent. And so it's forcing, you know, a bit of a chicken match and, you know, so no accommodation, businesses close. And of course, they still have the issue of paying the mortgage.
We went to dinner on Saturday night, my wife and I, at one of our favorite restaurants on 2nd Avenue here in Durango. And the only reason the restaurant really can stay alive is because it has outdoor seating right now. And she's going to be shutting the restaurant down in October, the owner of the restaurant, and hoping to open next spring when they can do outdoor seating. So it's strange. The businesses here in Durango, the restaurants anyway, that have stayed in business are the ones who can push out into the street and actually have outdoor seating. You just wonder what's going to change as we move into winter again. You know, a lot of these outdoor meetings, they're not going to continue to work.
I think one of the big differences is access to capital. In one sense, there's a deformation occurring in the corporate landscape, which we talked about last week in terms of sort of the zombification of certain companies. You if you have access to capital, you can continue to operate, even if you're not making any money. And then there's the small business owner, you know, 97,966 businesses that are closed and won't reopen. And that, you know, 100,000 businesses start attaching real lives and real stories and real dreams and aspirations to those numbers. And these are folks that did not have access to capital. And it really
Choosing winners. It goes back to choosing winners and losers.
It ends up consolidating a lot of the business community into the hands of a few very powerful, very connected, and away from the many, away from the person who says, you know, I think I just want to work for myself. I think I want to define what my vacation schedule looks like, and I think I want to define blah, blah, blah. And I'll be interested to see what the social ramifications of this are in terms of risk-taking if there is a new generation of entrepreneurs and risk-takers. And this is just sort of a timeout for an entire generation who said, you know, we were kind of thinking of retirement anyways. Let's just shut it down. Or if this changes the way people approach business and there's not a generation that says, you know, if you really want a guarantee, you work for the government and you got a good solid pension. And, you know, again, sort of a pulling back of the risk taking.
Is this just one more element that's formed when you have a Federal Reserve that can print money and lower rates? Those seem to be the two major tools that they use. Now they're telling us that a little bit more inflation is going to be good for us.
Yeah. I mean, it's you see malinvestment. As a result, you see malformation in terms of the business landscape. And I think you have this disconnect intellectually between what the Fed wants and what is actually occurring in the marketplace.
Well,
the Fed
and some are still wanting more stimulus than they've already thrown out.
Correct. You go to Kashkari, you go to a number who would encourage even more stimulus. And then there is a decent sized group that's content to wait. They want to see fiscal policy initiatives. They don't want to be in the crosshairs and fully responsible for what's occurring socioeconomically. And they feel like they've done what they needed to do in terms of quote unquote forward guidance. They lowered rates. They've told you it's going to be low till 2023. They've got a new inflation regime. You know, they're going to buy bonds and maintain certain prices. They're willing to use their balance sheet. So yeah, look at the bond market. You've got the bluff of buying any quantity of mortgages and treasuries. It's working. And yeah, I come back to Bullard's remarks. I think he's realistic in seeing inflation creep higher and then run hotter than expected. And that reflects the nature of inflation and kind of the consumer's response to it. Because by the time inflation is moving higher, expectations are either following it or just slightly leading it. And it becomes a tailwind, pushing it further than the Fed or any of the money mandarins would desire.
I remember one time landing Cessna. I hadn't gotten my license yet. I was just after solo. And I bounced. I hit the nose wheel. Okay, it was a tricycle landing gear aircraft. And I was trying to get it down, get it stopped. You know, you were talking earlier about being in a hurry with the swim. Well, you don't want to be in a hurry to get your plane down if you haven't learned how to flare, pull back. And I hit the nose wheel. But here's the problem. The problem was it wasn't just one bounce. I bounced, and then it came back down and hit again, and then it hit again, and it got worse and worse and worse. And I'm not going to – the end of the story was I survived.
You okay. Walked away. That was a good landing.
But it's called ballooning an aircraft. And in a way, inflation's like that. Once you hit that nose wheel, it's too late. You're going to balloon right off the runway. And that's what I'm wondering. When we get that inflation surprise, will it already be too late?
Well, I think it'll be too late in terms of the credibility at the Fed. And I suspect there's going to be a few uncomfortable months. Maybe it's 2022 or 2023 where inflation is moving aggressively higher and the Fed's stuck between its verbal commitment to accommodate. And then you've got them between that and the market tell-all, which is rates already moving higher, the market moving rates higher, the market taking them there, and the Fed being forced to get on board or, you know, again, lose all credibility. So I think the new inflation regime, you know, in terms of that wider targeting gives them some wiggle room because you just know that it's 2+. So anything over 2, they could still claim, you know, we're within our range. This is what we intended to do.
Is Powell so showing signs of squirming, though? I mean, when you listen to his speaking, is he saying what we are supposed to hear versus what he's actually thinking could come out?
You know, I couldn't help but go back and listen to some of the interviews. Tour de France ended this last week.
Right.
And so I was just curious. You know, the sport's changed a lot since the whole debacle with Lance Armstrong.
Yeah.
And I listened to some of his interviews, and it seemed, in at least the interviews I was listening to, that he was incapable of telling the truth, even though what he would proceed with was, now here's the honest truth, or here's the gospel truth. I mean, say, it was almost like you're putting way too much emphasis on
I'm telling the truth.
But you're not.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if there's not some sort of a psychological tell in that way. You know, Doug referred to, Noland, that is, referred to the Powell interview in the Credit Bubble Bulletin, noting that 10 times Powell used the word powerful. During his most recent press conference, you know, in talking about, you know, forward guidance and powerful and what we're doing is powerful. And it gave me that same sense, like, you know, it made me think that the unspoken concern was being shown. Does that make sense? They're really not in control. And so you've got to overplay your hand a little bit to say, oh, no, we're very much in control, very, very, very much in control, almost like the guy wearing a power tie. The guy who has to wear a power tie, he's not the guy in the room with the power.
When we have had central bankers on this commentary, it's interesting. I think they let their guard down a little bit. You know, it's an internet podcast. It's not a, you know, international broadcast type of television program. And so what we found when you interview these central bankers is their admittance of lack of control. That, you remember the statement, it's an art, not a science, and just talking about various failures in the past. And, you know, bankers, when you read what they write to each other, I remember the IMF report last year about possibly needing to go negative on interest rates that you talked about. And then the Bank of International Settlements has been throwing warnings out. The IMF has been throwing warnings out. So, Dave, I know you read that material. What are they saying? I mean, Bank of International Settlements just came out with a paper to themselves, right?
Yeah, it's a quarterly review, and, you know, they get to kind of look at the financial markets, they get to look at lending, and because they are central bank to the central bankers,
They're writing to bankers.
They are.
Right.
And it's both to the central bankers as well as commercial bankers. And so it's kind of on a related note, was going through that quarterly BIS paper this weekend. And the concerns that they highlighted, you know, the group in Basel, is that monetary policy is creating distortions. Again, none of this is new. So you just have to think about like who's saying it, and that's why it's important.
Right. And this is the Bank of International Settlements saying this.
Yeah. So one of the things they pointed out was that valuations for both equities and corporate credit are historically high. And they also pointed out that credit quality is deteriorating, even as credit spreads are shrinking. So that the benefit that you have of taking more risk, that benefit is diminishing over time as people are seeking yield, buying higher risk and getting paid less for it. And it's really in that environment of shrinking spreads, credit spreads, it's not a healthy reflection of risk. It's not risk being accurately priced. Another thing they mentioned is that inflation is rising. You've got real yields, which are moving lower. And they spent a good bit of time talking about dollar weakness and even more space given to the sort of disconnect between what they called subdued expectations for the real economy compared with the current stock market pattern. So stock market's up and away, and yet people are still very much concerned about the global economy. That disconnect, again, none of this is new. It's just the Bank of International Settlements saying, yep, monetary policy is creating distortions. Stocks are moving higher. We've got reason to, you know, keep our eye on this. And one of the things that they pointed out is that $250 billion has moved into this category of tier three or level three assets.
Which are, those are hard to define, aren't they? It's hard to know what a tier three asset is.
Not a lot of visibility in terms of the quality or the pricing. And so one of their conclusions, or that, you know, if they're connecting the dots between level three assets of commercial banks jumping to $250 billion and the sell-off in bank stocks, is that, in fact, not knowing what the risk is on the bank balance sheet is putting banks even further out of favor. You know, so what's the risk? What's the reward? If you can't quantify the risk, that's a problem. And then, of course, with interest rates continuing to move lower, net interest margin for your commercial banks is getting squeezed. So the reward side of the equation is also no longer making any sense. So what does a smart person do? Whether you're Warren Buffett or anyone else, you sell the asset. And so in essence, they're saying banks are being squeezed by monetary policy. The final big takeaway is that monetary policy, specifically lower rates, are responsible for the rise in stock prices and asset prices. Hmm. And again, that's no surprise.
They're admitting this wealth disparity that we talk about, and you're seeing riots in the street. This wealth disparity was caused by the central banks in many ways.
And again, it's not a surprise to you and I, but to hear the conclusion slip from the central banker's central bank is somewhat damning. Because right. You know, from that, you can also conclude that monetary policy is related, is responsible, is encouraging the income and wealth disparities that are one of the defining factors in terms of social unrest and sort of a soft form of class warfare.
And the question would be, where does it end, though? Does a central bank ever reverse something like that? You know, we talked about McChesney Martin saying, take away the punch bowl before it gets too bad. They haven't taken away the punch bowl. They've just brought many more in.
Right. And I go back to Neil Howe's program where he recently, when he was on as a guest, mentioned, I think the second time, because you mentioned it years ago, Walter Scheidel's book, The Great Leveler. Superb research on how these disparities in wealth are actually resolved. And it's not the tax man. And I mean, it comes down to four things in Scheidel's book: plague, war, revolution, and financial collapse. Those are the only ones that meaningfully shift the Gini coefficient. And the Gini coefficient is just how academics measure wealth disparities across time, so that, you know, you could be talking about the robber barons in period X or, you know, those in ancient Greece or Rome. And because we're talking about different monetary systems and everything else, it's a way of measuring wealth inequality across all time. But that's it. You've got plague, which ironically, we've got a little bit of that now. War, revolution, financial collapse, those are the only ways that it gets resolved in terms of extreme wealth disparity. The cause, uniquely in our time, the biggest cause of wealth disparity is monetary policy.
So the reversal, the leveler, like what you're talking about, plague, war, revolution, financial collapse, you know, just overall disparity. that seems to have started. And just let's play a game for a second. Let's go back and say we didn't have COVID this year. Let's just pretend we're going into an election and there was no COVID. There was no worldwide shutdown. What would it look like? What would it look like if we hadn't have had COVID this year?
Yeah, well, I mean, prior to COVID, Trump was the incumbent with a strong economy coming into a re-election where the primaries didn't reveal any strong opposition. I mean, COVID has been a gift from the gods of chaos to the Democrats. Even if it has not been a leveler, if it has not been to the extreme of solving the inequalities in wealth. But, you know, before the virus, Bloomberg reports that poverty was at a six-year low.
Now, this is Bloomberg.
Yeah, right. And okay. This is Michael, you know, sponsored and owned by Michael, who's promised to spend $100 million in Florida to defeat Trump. But still, I mean, there's some reporting here that's worth noting. Poverty was at a 60-year low with income surging. And this is to quote from a Bloomberg article. Median inflation-adjusted household income increased 6.8% last year to $68,703, among the fastest gains on record as more Americans got jobs and wages rose. And this is all information according to an annual data released by the U.S. Census Bureau. Poverty rate fell 1.3 percentage points to 10.5%, the lowest in data back to 1959.
Okay, so I just want to stress again, you're quoting Bloomberg. Okay, this isn't you. This is not an ad for Trump. You're just quoting Bloomberg.
No, and this is information gathered from the U.S. Census Bureau. So best data since 59, fifth straight decline. Again, we're talking about poverty rates, income, average in household income. In other words, go back prior to COVID. You've got an incumbent advantage. You've got a strong economy. You've got the primaries where they're eating each other alive. And to look back at Kamala Harris's comments about Joe Biden, it's actually very telling. He's a racist. He's all these things. now he's
good old Joe. Yeah, just good old Joe. But something changed, Dave. Something changed on September 18th.
You're right. And that marked a key transition in the election because September 18th, I mean, again, so you might have had COVID being a gift from the gods of chaos to the Democrats, but some other gods must like political volatility. Because whether you like Trump or hate him, last Friday, the transition in the race shifted from being about a man, Trump, to being about a woman.
Yeah.
That is the replacement of Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
The Supreme Court.
It was up to that point cast as an election voting against Trump. I don't think there was very many people lining up to vote for Biden. But now,
including Biden, I don't know if Biden, if he were voting, if he would know who to vote for.
You've got a national referendum on what we value most. So, I mean, again, because it's about a Supreme Court nomination, it's choice versus life, it's gun rights versus gun control. It's 1,000 other issues which the Supreme Court abides and interprets, obviously, through a lens. And it's that lens which is so critical. This is where all of a sudden the perspective that you have is, are we going to end up with a more conservative, a more liberal Supreme Court?
Well,
and this would be, if Trump gets what he wants, this would be the most conservative Supreme Court since the 1930s. So it's a whopper of a reason for both parties. And tragically, it's a two-party system. But both of these parties are going to whip up their bases with an amazing amount of fear, an amazing amount of hatred and loathing. And I'm not recommending this, but that's what's already occurring because you need people to feel so strongly that they don't sit at home and not vote.
It's nice to have an election, though, that has now become about issues, okay? Because personalities, if you're voting against a person, you're still not really addressing an issue, whatever that is.
Yeah.
At this point, it is issues.
And for all the attention that Black Lives Matter has had, it today is a sideshow. The left is going to have to focus all its energy on preventing a nomination and selection for Supreme Court of the United States. And liberals, along with... You look at the cast of characters who are sort of curiously in bed together, and it's liberals and many GOP have been apoplectic. I'm talking about politicians here. just because of Trump's personality, because of his policies, because of his non-beltway pressures.
Now they're being forced. Now the issues are being forced.
Yeah. So the GOP has something to rally around. This is the voter base, has something to rally around that's bigger than the man. And the Democrats, too, have something to rally around other than the man, I mean, whose ability to articulate anything seems to have an observable half-life. And I mean, yeah, I think Democrats are in a tough spot. They're in a tough spot after September 18th, post Ruth Bader Ginsburg, because suburban women could define the election.
Hmm. Or are you talking about security?
That's one aspect that's already been in play. There is some appeal for law and order in the context of looting and arson and a spike in crime in the context of Black Lives Matter. And so it was the New York Post that ran an article intriguingly titled, "Minneapolis City Council is Alarmed by the Crime Surge After Defunding Police."
Huh. Go figure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's okay.
But again, back to the suburban women, this is critical. They may define the election. And here's how it relates to the Supreme Court of the United States. You have to be careful how harshly you excoriate a Catholic mother of seven who, you know, included in that seven or two adopted children from Haiti. You have to be very careful what you say negative about a Cuban mother with three daughters, right?
Yeah.
This is not a Kavanaugh scorched earth campaign. It can't be.
Right.
It can't be. You have to be more respectful. You have to play to certain other fears, issue-driven fears, like what are we going to lose here? Are we going to lose Roe v. Wade? What are we going to lose here? What are we? So again, what criticisms will be legitimate? What criticisms will come across as misogynistic? The Democrats have to run a very fine line.
Did you see Cortez's comments, though? You were talking about scorched earth, and it almost looked to me like she was trying to inspire rioting when she talked about fighting from the streets to the Senate to keep any kind of nomination going through for the Republicans, for the SCOTUS.
Yeah, and we'll see. I mean, we'll see how we could interpret that or should interpret that, if it's a weather underground moment or if it is more just rhetorical. But yeah, AOC's comments, fighting from the streets to the Senate, if it's more than rhetoric, then the question is how hard to fight, right? That's a key question, because if it gets too dramatic in terms of pushing back a Supreme Court confirmation, there's the risk. The Democrats face the risk of rallying the silent majority, in which case Trump would have all the time he needs to nominate and confirm, four solid years to get that done.
Well, I know they're sitting around in the war room right now and trying to figure out what is the best strategy. What would you think would be the best strategy? Get it done before the election or after the election?
I mean, in terms of the Democratic strategy, you've got lawsuits already announced. You've got a relaunch of an impeachment. I mean, it's going to be 1,000 distractions. If I were Trump, I'd let the clock run out on the confirmation and run it down to the wire there in early November. Let the Democrats abuse the most qualified nominees. And what that would do is draw out the GOP's ire. You'd have so many people across America coming back to, wait a minute, this is a Catholic mother of seven, you know, teaching law at Notre Dame. She's no dope. This is a smart woman. This is a woman of character. Wait a minute. This is a Cuban mother with three daughters. I mean, the more you attack, the more you're going to anger the GOP, the voter base, and get them to come out, which is what I think Trump needs, is a base that says no more, no more. This is nonsense.
Do you remember George Friedman? You interview him often, but he wrote in one of his books, he talked about some of the most effective presidents are not necessarily the most likable presidents. And I thought that was interesting because there are a lot of people who don't like Trump, but issues matter in this election probably more than any time in American history.
Yeah, I've said this before, just how much I hate politics. And I mean, it's interesting from an investment standpoint to say, okay, what these are the possibilities. If this happens, then that happens. So the if-then scenarios, probabilities, outcomes, implications, these are all sort of curious things to try to figure out from a puzzle riddle perspective. But the human aspect of it I don't like it at all. I don't like it at all. And so we sat around the table last night talking about how effective presidents are not particularly likable, whether it's FDR or Lincoln or Reagan, even some of the things that, you know, like a Bush, who generally agreeable, but I certainly didn't like 2006 when, you know, he suspended habeas corpus. Same thing done by Lincoln back in, I think, 1860-something, 61. And it's, you know, again, the most likable president, somebody like Jimmy Carter, not a very effective president.
Not very effective. Well, no. You know, one of the arguments I think we're going to hear is that we don't have enough time to confirm a Supreme Court justice. But that's actually, that's not even close, is it?
No, in theory, it could all happen prior to the election. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was confirmed in 42 days. Sandra Day O'Connor was confirmed in 33 days. John Paul Stevens was confirmed in 19 days. And there are still, you know, as of this Wednesday, 44 days till the election. 70% of all justices have been confirmed in that kind of a time frame. There's actually one instance of a Chief Justice, John Marshall, being nominated after the election by the loser and confirmed
during
before,
the lame duck.
Yes, yeah. Before the baton pass from John Adams to Thomas Jefferson.
Well, we thought we were actually voting for four more years. Right. If a person's voting for Trump, or a different 4 years if they were voting for Biden. But when you're talking about the Supreme Court, you're not talking that short time frame. You're talking about decades, possibly.
Yeah, because I think that's the reason why this election season may be even more divisive than what we've seen for generations. I mean, look, assuming that conservatives aren't asleep at the wheel, but appreciate that Trump is just there for 4 years. If he is reelected, it's 2021 to the Supreme Court justice replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg would influence U.S. culture for decades to come.
Right.
So even if you don't like him, do you want Democrats determining the next Supreme Court of the United States? And the same is true. I could say that the opposite way. Even if you don't like Biden, again, that fact alone will bring out a lot of voters from both sides of the aisle. I would bet participation is off the charts. I would bet participation even surpasses 2008.
I know you, Dave, you don't like politics. You don't like talking about politics on this show. But we do look at the markets, and politics can influence the market. What are the implications? I mean, Biden, Trump, what are the implications in the market at this point?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons I don't like politics is because it doesn't put the best of humanity on display. And it doesn't draw the best out of those in leadership. It is a cutthroat world of very sophisticated chess playing. And
the truth doesn't matter.
Truth does not matter. Being disingenuous is a part of the role that you play. I look at it and it just, I don't know. One of the places, if I ever need to go to be disappointed in humanity, I just think about Washington, D.C. And there are exceptions to that, but they are notable exceptions. They stand out. And
we have listeners that are exceptions to that. Yes.
Yes.
Senators that are listeners.
That's right. That's right.
Thank you, by the way.
But over the weekend, we covered our views. We tried to do that charitably in our Hard Asset Insights. We do that every week on Friday. And we're just looking at the implications. What are the implications of a Biden victory? What are the implications of a Trump victory? The markets are going to be on edge with November fast approaching, but there are real tangible implications if you're talking about tax policy, which would shift with that president, impacting corporate profits and thus impacting prices. So, you know, regardless of what the Fed does to suspend the sun, moon, and stars, they're going to have a lot more heavy lifting to do given a certain outcome.
Dave, once a year we have a question and answer program where we ask our listeners to send in questions. And each time, every year, they seem to get more and more interesting, the questions. And sometimes we just get comments from listeners. And, you know, last week you were talking about Tesla. And one of our listeners, who happens to be very close to the automotive industry as far as the mechanical side, he made a comment that Tesla reminds him a whole lot of DeLorean, you know, 30 years ago. So I thought that was an interesting comment.
John DeLorean was quite a personality.
Hmm.
And some would have said he was a genius. He could have run General Motors, and he didn't. He wanted to do his own thing.
They were really interesting looking cars. DeLoreans.
They were. Yeah. They were.
Yeah. Back to the Future.
Now, you know, last week we talked about Tesla versus the automotive universe. And, you know, it was last Friday. By the end of the week, last Friday, GM announces the Ultium Drive family of electric motors. So you've got five electric drivetrains, you've got three motors. And that was one of the points. That was one of the takeaways. When there is sufficient demand, when it's profitable to produce and sell, you've got the auto companies producing and selling 50 million units. Mm-hmm. They're not going to miss the boat on right. electric vehicles. So, yeah, I mean, at this point, Teslas are going to need a little bit more than fancy software upgrades and that sleek body style. They look nice, but they're going to need a little bit more than that to keep them going down the road.
Well, and I just wonder, okay, if because last week you talked about these other companies like GM, Toyota, what have you, you know, succeeding probably more than Tesla ultimately will. I just wonder if it'll be a Tesla, not a DeLorean, in the Back to the Future movie that maybe is going to be filmed in 2050. You know, it's like, what's that? Oh, yeah, kids, this was a Tesla. Yeah, yeah.
Well, we know history is written by the victors, and DeLorean did not actually get to sort of write his own book about the success story of the DeLorean Motor Company. Maybe Tesla will be different. Time will tell if a lot of the shenanigans that are financed by today's credit system are pure genius or pure lunacy.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, and you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.